Okay. Good evening. Welcome to the Thursday, September 20th meeting of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. Okay. Roll call, please.
Sure. Member Vardis.
Here.
Member Lucy.
Present.
Member Talley.
Here.
Member Wallace.
Here.
Vice Chair Molnar.
Present.
Okay. Let the record show that we do have a quorum.
Okay. The second item on the agenda is officer appointments.
Thank you. John Diodati with the Public Works Department. We have a new process in place because of the adoption of the amendments to the bylaws, and the chair and vice chair are now on a rotating basis. Chair is the city of Arroyo Grande, and vice chair is the city of Grover Beach. With the absence of Arroyo Grande, Member Molnar is chairing the meeting.
Thank you. Is there any discussion or comment on that? No? All right, thank you. We'll move to item three, which is public comment. Is anyone in the audience wish to come forward and speak on any item that is not on the agenda? I see none. We will move forward to item number four, the meeting minutes of May 17th. Is there any discussion or anyone have any changes to make to the minutes?
Madam Chair, I'd abstain on voting on this. I wasn't at that meeting.
All right, thank you.
I likewise do the same.
All right. Well, that leaves three of us.
I move that we accept the minutes.
I second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. The meetings have been accepted. We move on to item number five, the operations report.
Thank you. And that will be done by Mr. Craig Kessler.
Thank you.
Water treatment plant's running well. No major incidents since the last time I reported in. Current plant production is 5 MGD. Filter turbidity range is 0.01 to 0.02.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions or comments?
Just a question, Madam Chair.
Please.
Craig, on the table for the monthly operations report, we're showing the usage of various amounts of water and so forth. Is the amount listed for surplus, the 1,831.15 acre feet for August, is that the declared surplus or is that an estimated surplus? Is that the final surplus that was determined?
I don't, John, I don't do any of these calculations on this. Ron Coleman is responsible for that. So
okay, no problem.
I can't answer.
No problem.
All right, and I see Mr. Coleman is not here tonight.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm actually taking his spot tonight.
All right, thank you. Any other questions?
No.
Okay. All right. And any? Are you going to do item B, the dam storage and creek release?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. The lake elevation is 510.40. Storage in acre feet is 38,951. Capacity is 79.2%. Downstream release is 5 MGD. And I missed state water, 2.1 MGD, from the operations report.
All right, thank you. Any questions or comments? All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. All right. We will move on to item six, which is the budget. No?
Vice Chair Molnar, if we could please move item 9B up at this time because of a scheduling conflict with Mr. Ogren, who's handling this item. If we could have that go now, it would be appreciated.
Is everyone in agreement with that?
Yes.
All right, then we will do that. Thank you. 9B.
Good evening. Pablo Ogren, Public Works Director. You know, I really don't have a presentation on this. What John had indicated to me was at the last meeting that there was some general discussion about the possibility of contract amendments. And so I thought I'd come out here in order to have the discussion and gain a better understanding of what might be on the minds of the advisory committee. The idea that, you know, one of the things that I think is important to recognize is the contracts were sort of fully renegotiated in around 2000 in order to do the seismic job and the water treatment plant job. As we had discussed in prior meetings, one of the sort of underlying issues that is different in the Nacimiento contracts as opposed to the Lopez contracts is the role of the Nacimiento Commission or the Zone 3 Advisory Committee, and whether or not this is an issue that really needs to be discussed amongst the cities and the attorneys and the staff of the cities in order to make a proposal to the county. Again, I'm not clear on what the driving issue here is for desired contract amendments.
Does anyone want to add to this or ask questions?
Well, I'm curious. I think I missed at least one of the previous meetings. I'm curious how this topic came up and why it's agendized. Is it in regards to specific contracts with one of the cities or one of the participating entities?
No, I think there was just a general type of a discussion. But again, that's where I'm sort of at a loss is what's being proposed or what's the driving need for a contract amendment? Because that's usually how it works. You know, in 2000, we needed to have contract amendments in order to address the financing of the seismic remediation project and then the water treatment plant project. And so there was a driving need to open up the contracts, look at them, make amendments to them. And we ended up in 2000 essentially doing a wholesale rewrite of the contracts. And that was a very long and really, you know, laborious process. It took about a year altogether. But there was a driving need in order to be able to get the contracts in a shape so we could go out there and get municipal financing for those major projects. The difference then, Nacimiento Commission was subsequently adopted, and they had a procedural change that was a little bit different. And so in order to make sure that it's consistent with Nacimiento, that's how we went through the change on the bylaws.
There was discussion previously about the interest of trying to transform this body into more of a, not just an advisory panel, but to have more of a decision-making capacity. Was that at all related to the genesis of this? Or is that something separately completely different?
I think that that's a logical type of a question. But that issue itself was really fully vetted when the original contracts were developed and then when they were renegotiated in 2000. One of the substance challenges of it is that the county still holds the liabilities associated with making sure that the regulatory requirements associated with water quality are maintained, the staffing and everything. And so it's not one of those situations where this body here could be the final decision-making body over in operations of the county. And so both the Nacimiento Commission and the Zone 3 Advisory Committee work substantially the same, which is reviewing issues, taking action, and in my career, I really don't know of any times when the Board of Supervisors has adopted an action that differs from what, you know, the commissions or the committees do. But that possibility does exist because the Board of Supervisors is still the entity that owns the facilities and is ultimately responsible for them. But it was the procedural change in order to help with transparency in government and making sure that everything is out on the table, that if there is a conflict between the actions of the advisory committee or the desires of the advisory committee and what staff might be bringing to the Board of Supervisors, then the process has changed to make sure there has to be a hearing so that there can be a full discussion and that county staff doesn't slip something into the board's consent agenda and, you know, move forward without due process, if you will. So this issue of trying to divide up authorities or to make sure what is the proper authorities is something, again, that, I mean, I was part of the negotiations and the discussions in 2000, and that was something that was part of the year-long discussions. So then it begs the question, well, okay, what's changed since 2000? Because certainly all of the attorneys for all the agencies in the county, you know, scratched their head a lot on that issue and sort of fully vetted it. And so how would we seek changes in authorities and those types of things? And, you know, it's a really broad, open type of a question. And I guess my point is that we feel that it was fully addressed in 2000, and so what's changed since then?
Well, maybe I can make a little bit of a clarification here, is that when we talked about strengthening the powers of the committee, you know, just maybe putting them out a little bit more and, you know, and strengthening the mission statement, a couple people took it to the extreme, you know, went down, you know, the most horrid legal road you could possibly think of. And it's called, you know, contract amendments and stuff. But that was never the intent of the bylaws change. And, in fact, that language was thrown out by staff and stuff. I mean, as one of the makers of the bylaw changes, right, that discussion was too far out of the realm of what we were discussing, which was to strengthen a body that in an advisory role, you know. So I guess I'm somewhat at a little loss because I thought we had put it to bed at that time.
And that we nobody wanted to. Example: county staff wanted to be as responsive as possible and make sure that we've got the issue nailed down.
If that's the case, I have
a good
list.
Follow-up.
No commercials. I have a question.
Oh, okay.
Pablo, as I understand the changes to the bylaws, the new bylaws that we have, do they parallel pretty closely the Nacimiento Commission bylaws?
Well, what they do is in the bylaws we incorporate the procedure that happens to be part of the contract for Nacimiento, which is,
okay,
you know, and to me, everybody's approved that. The board has approved it.
Yeah. Now, I know it's been approved. I just didn't know if this was a replica of the Nacimiento Commission. I haven't seen those bylaws, and I don't know when.
Yeah, you know, what it means is that the bylaws for the Zone 3 Advisory Committee are stronger than the bylaws for the Nacimiento Commission.
Really? Okay.
Oh, in what way?
Well, because we have this due process issue incorporated into the bylaws. Then the argument is the Nacimiento contracts are stronger, you know. When you take the contracts together with the bylaws, they're on par with each other. It's just in the Nacimiento side, it's part of the contracts. On Zone 3, it's part of the bylaws. So together, they're the same. The Nacimiento contracts are stronger. Their bylaws are weaker. The Zone 3 contract is weaker, and its bylaws are stronger. So,
well, would you hazard an opinion as to which is better?
At the end, it's the same.
Okay.
You know, we've just accomplished it in two different paths. We've got to the same end point, but we've taken two paths to get there.
Okay. All right. Is everyone fine with that?
Thank you.
Thank you for that report.
The bylaws for Nacimiento have incorporated the contract provision for the procedure, so they reference it in the bylaws.
Well, as well.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. All right. Yes.
With regard to this issue, by the way, Dwayne Chisholm, City of Pismo Beach, in the minutes there's a reference to Jim Gehring talking about part of what this item was about changing the way the voting is occurring, and you may want to wait until he comes back to discuss some of that matter, because I think that's what that was about. But there is a issue with regards to the City of Pismo Beach and some financial arrangements that have been discussed with the city managers, and there may be a minor contract change that may be necessary in order to facilitate that. It's not on this particular subject, but it's something I know the county's aware of.
I guess you'll be back.
Well, and I can, as a little bit of a preview on both of those items. So in the Nacimiento Commission, their voting is in proportion to their water allocations. So Paso Robles has 4,000 acre feet out of almost 10,000 acre feet. So you take those ratios, and that's Paso Robles' voting percentages. But I do recall that I believe at a previous Zone 3 Advisory Committee, we talked about that, and that the committee was fine with the existing voting, where each agency just basically has an equal vote. One of the reasons why I think it's different on Nacimiento, the voting is different, is because only 60% of the water is subscribed and 40% of it is yet to be sold. And so there's a really significant decision there in terms of who might buy future water. In contrast, all of the Zone 3 water is already allocated. You know, there's no unavailable water. But again, on the voting percentages, I recall the Zone 3 talking about that and saying that they're fine on the allocations. The financing issues of which Dwayne is speaking to has to do with how the property taxes are collected and applied against bills. And because Pismo Beach's property taxes have increased quicker than the other agencies, the idea is that their debt service is lower but they don't get the full benefit of their property taxes. That was envisioned in 2000, that could happen, and so it was fully discussed in 2000. And our basic position on how that financing issue works is that it's really not a county issue. It's how the costs are allocated amongst the agencies. And in 2000, it was sort of like the mayor of Arroyo Grande and the mayor of Pismo Beach were looking at that, and they sort of kind of came up with a compromise in 2000. But if that specific issue wants to be readdressed, then our position is that, well, a change would be to the benefit of the city of Pismo Beach, so it would be a matter of city of Pismo Beach sitting down with the other agencies and talking about whether there should be a change on that provision. But it doesn't affect the county at all, because all those property taxes still come in. They help to pay for the debt service. It's just a simple, it's a financing issue between Pismo and the other agencies. It's a zero-sum game for the county. And so it's sort of like if there is something to be negotiated there, then we think that's between the agencies to negotiate. And whatever the agencies want to do is fine with us. If they want to keep the way it's working right now, then that's okay. If they want to modify it, then that a modification might be desired by the cities and Oceano. Then bring it forward. But if the city managers aren't inclined to see that it's going to change, then, you know, but that's really where it's not for county staff to say that it should change, because I get when it was negotiated in 2000, we talked about the issue, but it was really the compromise was developed between the agencies, and we were like, okay, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? What do you want to do? And they all came up to an agreement on it, so then we got it, you know, inked and signed and everything. But it wasn't something that we were negotiating.
I understand what you're saying, but if the city of Pismo feels that they have that they've outgrown that particular portion of the contract, perhaps then it would be better if they get together with other city managers and come up with a proposal or a discussion about that.
That
would be my suggestion.
Yeah.
And then bring it to us when they were ready.
That's right, and the county will stay neutral on the issue.
Okay.
Well, the question is, does the advisory board, we don't have to take any action on that, do we? Or do we have to ratify any changes? No. Maybe.
You don't really have to take action on it, because it would be action of your city councils and of the board of supervisors. The issue is that if the city managers and the attorneys feel like an amendment is appropriate, then I think it would be appropriate for them to come and explain it to the advisory committee. But really, it's first and foremost going to be a decision of all of your city councils and Oceana CSD and everything.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Okay. So, Mr. Chisholm, are you prepared to go back and discuss this with your city manager and go forward if that is what you need? And then we will be very willing to listen to anything that you have to propose. All right, thank you. All right, then let's move on to item 6, which is the budget.
Thank you. And Jenny Brunick from the Accounting Division will be making this presentation.
Good evening. Jenny Brunick, County Public Works. Tonight I will be presenting the fourth quarter budget status report for Flood Control Zone 3. The first graph represents routine operations and maintenance. As of the fourth quarter, O&M is under budget by 10%, or $333,000. The majority of the savings comes from the water treatment plant, and this is due to the vacancy of the water systems worker 3, which is currently being recruited for, and the membrane filter service agreement, which is on an as-needed basis. Other savings include expenditures such as the countywide overhead, cathodic protection maintenance, the stream gauge maintenance, and the office engineering. The second graph represents non-routine. This is over budget by 17%, or $41,000. The majority of the savings comes from the environmental monitoring and water quality efforts special projects. These two line items have been reduced significantly in the new fiscal year. The third quarter represents capital outlay reserves. Capital outlay is under budget by $67,000. This is due to the water line crossing Rodriguez Bridge and the access road domestic tank. Both projects are underway, and expenditures will be reflected in the first two quarters of fiscal year 12-13. So in total, flood control zone 3, 11, 12 costs were under budget by about 26%. And this concludes my report. And if you have any questions, happy to answer.
Any questions? No? You? Yes. Mr. Wallace.
Jeannie, I had a question. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I've ever heard of county overhead going down. So can you explain what happened there and why the savings that resulted from countywide overhead going down?
I don't calculate the countywide overhead, but my understanding is there was credits due to not just our zone 3 throughout the public works, the special district budgets. So everyone received a credit, and I want to see it's based on the expenditures. And let me see if Pablo's left.
he knew the question was coming up, so he left.
You're on your own.
I'm on my own. So I don't have a clear answer for you, but I know that the dollar amount was
$41,000.
Reduced it. I don't have it in front of me.
Was it 41? No, that's not.
No, no, no. That was 41. I want to say the credit was somewhere around $29,000, so it reduced our overhead.
That's okay.
I'll get the answers and I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah, I didn't see
I apologize.
I didn't see that split up in your savings there, and it was a pleasant surprise. But I was surprised that countywide overhead went down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'll get back. I'll get with our accountant and all. I apologize.
We don't know what's going to happen when I push this button. Okay, so I am Mark Hutchinson. I'm the Environmental Division Manager for the Department of Public Works, and this is a regular update on the status of the Rio Grande Creek Habitat Conservation Plan. You'll notice this is the schedule that we have been working with since the first of the year, and it shows that in July I was to give a general overview of the various environmental laws, regulations, and processes that we're moving through in this process. This is essentially background information for your committee. Hopefully you'll be able to put these handouts in a place where you can keep it and have some ability at some point in the future to understand some of the acronyms that we're going to start tossing around shortly as we try to move this project through to the level where it can be processed and start going through the actual approval phases that it faces. At the end, I'll also give you a very brief work status update as to where we are with the HCP. So there are actually five key statutes. There are several others that might be involved in our project tonight. I just want to give an overview, again, of CEQA, NEPA, the Federal Endangered Species Act, the California Endangered Species Act, and the National Historic Preservation Act, all of which will or may come into play in our project. This is a summary flowchart of how this project is going to work. You can see across the top is the HCP itself. We are in the yellow, the pre-submittal phase, still developing the document and at this point waiting on the engineers to complete their work on the downstream water availability analysis before we get into the next phase of HCP development. Concurrent with the post-submittal phase, we will be involved in a NEPA document. And a subset of that will be Section 106 compliance. I'll cover these in more detail in the presentation. There will be a CEQA document, and the bottom is California Endangered Species Act, and our hope is that there will not be a California Endangered Species Act document. I wanted to just start with CEQA, just basic information on the board, and also mention that this is the one environmental law that I think all of us in the room and certainly on your committee are familiar with. Every city council, the CSDs in the county on almost a daily basis deals with CEQA, EIRs, and negative decks. We're very much familiar, having been involved in it, with how it works, how the different processes go together. This is an advantage as we go through, so we'll know what we're talking about. On the other hand, it may be a little bit of a disadvantage because we tend to bring our assumptions and perspective on CEQA into play when we deal with the other regulations. To some degree, they're similar, but in other ways, they are extremely dissimilar, and we sometimes find ourselves at an advantage if we take a CEQA viewpoint, especially on the Endangered Species Act. And I'll try to highlight that as I go through. But again, CEQA, adopted in California, signed by Governor Ronald Reagan in 1971, actually signed in 1970 and went into effect in January 1971. And very briefly, that's the law that requires decision makers, boards, commissions, and agencies to document, consider, and respond to environmental implications of projects and actions that we take. It, by and large, is a procedural law. Many regulations and guidelines about how we go about documenting impacts, how we go about involving the public, how agencies work together. But the teeth of CEQA is summed up in this phrase, where it says agencies should not approve projects as proposed if there are feasible alternatives or feasible mitigation measures that would substantially lessen significant environmental effects. Early on in CEQA, in the 1970s, agencies leaned on the should, and it became very clear through numerous court actions that the operative word actually is shall. The way the law is written in other sections, this would be much clearer if it was simply said agencies must not approve projects unless we look at alternatives and consider mitigation. And we're all used to that, I think. I wanted to put this up. This is the kind of lingo that I use, and I'm sure everyone on your dais is familiar with. You know, we talk about initial studies, and then we talk about NDs and mitigated NDs, notice of preps and EIRs and all of those sorts of things, which comes out of the CEQA process. And then there's the CEQA flowchart. This is out of actually the Public Works Environmental Process Manual, so it's custom. But the yellow highlights is what we anticipate for our HCP project. We've had preliminary discussions with the county environmental coordinator, so we anticipate that we'll go down the right side and process an environmental law and consider the environmental implications of projects and actions. Notice it says consider. NEPA itself does not require any agency to actually do anything about an impact. Requires them to consider it. On the other hand, it requires decision makers to document compliance with other federal environmental laws. To illustrate the difference between CEQA and NEPA, if I had the documents in front of me, we would see that CEQA, the law itself, in 8.5 by 11 pages, 12 point, is about an inch thick. The guidelines to CEQA are about an inch and a half thick. NEPA itself, that stack of paper, is about a quarter of an inch high. The law is substantially less. Regulations for NEPA are established by CEQ, the Council on Environmental Regulations. It's an office of the president. The CEQ regulations may be half an inch. But then the CEQ regulations require each and every federal agency to develop their own procedures or guidelines for implementing NEPA. So at the cabinet level, Department of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, each of those has adopted NEPA guidelines for that branch. The ones that I typically work with would be Federal Highway Administration, most commonly U.S. Department of Agriculture, Housing and Urban Development. Each of those has NEPA guidelines that, if stacked up, would be 3 and 4 feet high. Further within those, we work with, say, the Federal Aviation Administration to produce NEPA documents. Both they and FHWA are Department of Transportation, but you would not detect any similarities in the way they apply NEPA. It is on the ground where I work, a substantially different law depending on which federal agency you're working with. In our case, we'll be working with National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. One of those is Department of Commerce, the other is Department of Interior. However, at this point, Fish and Wildlife has agreed to defer to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service when we get to producing a NEPA document. But there will be a challenge there to get both agencies to accept a single document as their own rather than trying to produce two separate documents due to differences in their regulations and their perspectives. Interesting about CEQA and NEPA is the way the acronyms work together. You notice NEPA's got EA, CEQA was IS, Environmental Assessment Initial Study. They both use CE, but one's a categorical exclusion and one's a categorical exemption. I like FONSI, finding of no significant impact. CEQA calls that a negative declaration, and then so on and so forth. And obviously, EIS versus EIR, and the other ones, record of decision versus notice of determination. I should have paused on the CEQA one. We like NEPA notice of availability. That's the one that you publish to tell people you have a draft EIR ready for the public to look at. CEQA calls that a notice of completion, and the only problem with that title is that it's actually not complete. But I have time explaining that. This is a simplified NEPA flowchart, and you notice that we do not anticipate an environmental impact statement on the NEPA side. NEPA and the agencies, how shall I say, where we take a local perspective on impacts and document type, these agencies take a national perspective. It's as if they're standing on a hill in Washington, D.C. and looking across the country at California. A project of this size simply does not appear to be something that they would produce an environmental impact statement for. It is important that we continue to work with the agencies to maintain that perspective because while an EIR can be complex, an EIS is extremely complex simply in the way the agency processes it internally in Washington, D.C., and the way they coordinate with other agencies, most notably US EPA. But we do strongly anticipate an environmental assessment and a finding of no significant impact on this project. This one is Federal Endangered Species Act, and obviously that's the one that's requiring us to do an HCP in the first place. And I want to zip through this one because, as you notice on your schedule, a month from now I'm due to give you a presentation on the post-submittal process, and that's really the focus on this. So this will just be an introduction. We'll zip through it, define some terms, and then in 2 months have just an individual presentation and look a little bit more detail so that as we get heavily into that, we know what we're doing. The need for a habitat conservation plan is simply driven by the fact that we have three federally listed species in our creek. Obviously, steelhead trout, this was listed as threatened species in 1997. I would stop at this point and say that on the ground there's typically no practical difference between a species being listed as endangered or threatened under the Act. The procedures and the requirements that we follow in most cases are identical. There is a difference in steelhead trout, and believe it or not, it pertains to road maintenance projects, which it's its own presentation. But for our project, endangered, threatened, really no difference in how the agencies look at them and no difference in the procedures that we have to go through. United States, not just federal agencies or state agencies, but even individuals are required to comply with the Endangered Species Act. I would note that most of the questions that I get on the Endangered Species Act have been answered at some point in the Act's history through litigation at the federal level. This law was passed in 1973 and was immediately litigated all the way to the Supreme Court by the Tennessee Valley Authority. And interestingly, it concerned a small fish about the size of a tidewater goby called a snail darter. And the precedent sent by those court decisions have been upheld over the last 30 years, now 40 years. That really did establish that this is a different law than any other environmental law, state or federal. If you charted it on a graph as far as the impact and as far as intent and as far as impact that is on our decision making, it is far and above much more prescriptive than, say, CEQA or even NEPA. Where in CEQA we look at balancing things, the Federal Endangered Species Act does not provide for balancing. Or I should say that it provides for a multi-year process that can eventually lead to a presidential committee, where that committee, appointed by the president, could, in certain circumstances, essentially override the provisions of the Act. And to my knowledge, the committee has been convened one time in the history of the Act and found against the applicant. So nobody else has even tried it. It requires federal agencies to use all of their authority to protect listed species, and I should have underlined, and their habitats. We often are caught by surprise. Some folks feel that a species that does not exist in their county or their state affects their project because the habitat does exist. This is administered on the ground by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service, and we're lucky to have both agencies. I pulled this out of the Federal Register. There are quite a bit of provisions in the Act about what we can and can't do, but one of the specific prohibited activities, as you notice, is removing water or otherwise altering stream flow when it significantly impairs essentially essential behavior patterns of an endangered species. That is the specific regulation that's driving our HCP. Where we have dammed the creek and we're withdrawing water, the question is, are we significantly impairing essential behavior patterns? The agencies have essentially accepted that we are, and so we're into the HCP process. What the HCP really is a process specified by the Act whereby producing a big mitigation plan, we can get a permit to essentially take species, that is, harm, harass, kill, or otherwise interfere with their essential life patterns. The HCP is a mitigation plan. And these are requirements out of the Act that have to be in that plan. Notice it says incidental take. Under Section 10, you can't actually get a permit to kill an endangered species. We can get a permit to take water, and then incidentally we might affect an endangered species, but to directly get a permit to take one is actually not available under Section 10. A person could get a scientific take permit, which is not really what we're up to. And then approval of that take permit requires the agencies to find that, first, it's incidental and that the impacts are minimized and mitigated. Again, that's what the HCP is all about, that we've provided adequate funding, and that, here's the last one, taking will not appreciably reduce the likelihood of survival and recovery of the species in the wild. Over the years, through various amendments to the Act, minor amendments, and litigation primarily, it's been clarified that phrase actually provides or applies to populations and subpopulations. So the Act is looking at Arroyo Grande Creek as if the steelhead that are endemic to this stream are the only ones in existence on the earth. Yeah. The fact that there are steelhead in other streams and all the way up into Canada and Alaska is not relevant to what we're doing in Arroyo Grande Creek. Because these fish return to the stream they respond in, they're considered a distinct subspecies or equivalent to that, and so we have to treat the steelhead in Arroyo Grande Creek as if they're the only ones in existence. And I know, from side conversations that this has been problematic sometimes for the agencies. The public will spend a substantial amount of money, as in our case, to maintain a population of steelhead in Arroyo Grande Creek, whereas, say, from a CEQA perspective, we might say, if we took one-tenth of that money and invested in Santa Rosa Creek or San Simeon or San Carpoforo, we could generate better habitat and many, many more fish in a much stronger population. But the Act does not allow that to occur because of these kinds of provisions. Just a slide on terminology to tuck away in your binders. Take and incidental take, Section 7 and Section 10 HCPs. Next time we'll be talking about implementing agreements, biological assessments and opinions, this wonderful phrase, reasonable and prudent measures flowchart, but notice every single one on this chart is colored in. No alternatives, no options. This is the Section 7 process, and this is why discussion of this is a separate topic for next meeting, because we simply don't have time to figure out what all of those boxes mean and what we're about to launch ourselves into when we submit this HCP to the agencies. I did want to talk briefly about this one. You may not have known previously, but there is a California Endangered Species Act. In some ways, it's similar to the federal act, in other ways, substantially different. It, too, dates from the 1970s. It uses the term take. It does extend the prohibition on take to species that are not yet listed. Department of Fish and Game has the ability to put species on a consideration list, although they rarely do. And it has this interesting thing about listed plants on private properties. Believe it or not, the federal law can list a plant as endangered, but the plants on private properties are not subject to the take prohibitions in the Act, only the animals. Slight difference.
Question, so they are for the State Endangered Species Act or not? So that only applies to the exemption for private properties for the federal endangered?
For the federal endangered. So
not for the state?
Not for the state. So if a plant is state-listed endangered, then take of that plant is prohibited by a private landowner. If it's only listed as endangered under the federal law, the private landowner is not prohibited from take of the plant.
And the CNPS rare plants is only covered pursuant to CEQA. So the, I'm just talking here. But the CNPS rare plants, that's only that's not an issue here.
No, that really comes into play in CEQA. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
There's a provision in the California Endangered Species Act that if a person was subject to both and got your federal permit, that you could provide for a you could apply for a consistency determination. You could get your federal permit and then go to the state and say, look, same species, similar act, I have my HCP, I have my mitigation stuff, you know, here it is, stamp it on the bottom, I've got coverage under both. However, you see the bullets down there, and Fish and Game is nice enough to actually put that on their website. The howevers from Fish and Game essentially say that although it's provided for in law, they're not going to do it. So if we were subject to both, had an endangered state endangered species we were going to impact, we would be running both processes in parallel in order to ensure coverage. Now, the reason I bring this up is because of this. That's Elise Bell's vireo. He's about 4 to 5 inch long little bird. Is listed endangered under the federal law and under the state law. And the key thing that it's endangered under state law. This, for many, many years, was is an endangered species considered endemic to Southern California. Its preferred habitat is dense riparian forests, particularly willows, where there's floodplains that have been dominated. And through disturbance, you'd have significant willow growth. About 2 years ago, during biological surveys for the Nacimiento Water Project, we discovered a male Elise Bell's vireo in the Salinas River north of Paso Robles. That's got the attention of the agencies, and so we're now routinely doing bird surveys for this particular species when we're working in and around creeks. So while it is not present to our knowledge in Arroyo Grande Creek, and more importantly, we do not believe that any of the activities of HCP would have a significant impact on this bird. That is, there would not be take even if it were there. So at this point, we're very strongly not moving towards including this bird in our HCP. Not necessarily because of the federal side, but because it triggers an entirely and complex state process alongside. So our goal is to design the HCP in a way that even if the vireo does show up in Arroyo Grande Creek, we're not doing anything that would actually result in take of the species or its habitat. But I did want to make sure you're aware of that in case someone at one of your councils would ask the question about the vireo, because when they do show up, it's big news among the birder community in the county.
Right. I don't know if this is the proper time to ask you this. Is that I'm going to ask it anyway. Oceano, you know, recently there's been a report out that there's far more a variety of species in Oceano than there is in the Osoflaco Lake area. So I know that people have, you know, the bird watchers do come flocking when the little bird comes to town. But what I wanted to talk to you about is the environment in which the Arroyo Grande Creek has come since. It appears that, you know, that we oversee the policies and procedures of that waterway, right? That we don't
microphone in front of
you. But 12 big willow trees coming down at night, you know, it's blocking that creek. And so how does any of that fall into that? When you apply for your permits, do they say, well, you got toilet paper all through this creek and stuff like that, you know, we're not going to give you a permit for this.
Typically not. I mean, as
it's
you know,
it's really gotten so severe now. I mean,
right. Well, as you know, Flood Control Zone 1 has developed their waterway management plan, completed the EIR, received the coastal development permit for part of it. And applications throughout all of these processes, although they're under a different part of the Endangered Species Act, are fully underway. So we do anticipate being able to go into the flood control reach and actively manage the habitat that's there, both to the benefit of the habitat and also right. The water and water quality.
And please do correct me if I'm wrong. That only goes to the 22nd Street Bridge?
It extends down behind the wastewater treatment plant, not all the way to the ocean at this point. But there are activities.
So it goes down to 21st. You know, I mean, it's really not that far. 22nd Street and the Sand District, that's not, you know, that's...
Well, it extends
not
from...
That
it extends
generous,
from,
okay.
It extends
the
from
problem
Valley
is
Road
past
all the
that.
Way down. Oh, yeah. Well, and at the lower end, interestingly, is in the state park, where we don't have jurisdiction. So it's... I'm anticipating that if we manage to get permits for the waterway management plan and start actively implementing that program on an ongoing basis, it could spur state parks to look closely at their part of the creek and move ahead with some plans that they had. They had an HCP underway and some other things that have been stalled, and I understand starting to crank up.
And I know you've had a really, really hard time getting the permits. I'm totally sympathetic to that. But those permits only go so far down. It's not going to...
Well, from the Sand District all the way up to Valley Road. So just about the upper end of the wastewater plant, maybe not quite that far. Below Delta and down to the airport, definitely.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right, let's continue on.
Okay. Vireos. National Historic Preservation Act. This dates from 1996 and has undergone amendments. It's not something that we commonly deal with in our local projects. At the Public Works Department, it's become much more prominent because it comes into play when we get involved with federal funds. And as you know, through Los Osos and other projects, we've been able to access significant funds through the State Water Board's revolving fund, which is federal, and also USDA. And so we've had to deal with National Historic Preservation Act. Things like the ACHP and State Historic Preservation Office, you'll hear that pronounced SHPO, the National Register, and something called the Section 106 review process. On the ground, this looks a lot like what we would do in CEQA for cultural and archaeological resources, but it's much more prescriptive, much more detailed, and holds much more sway over a project that contains cultural resources than does the cultural resource sections of CEQA. It involves four primary steps, which sound very simple. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, start the process, identify the historic properties, assess the adverse effects, and resolve the adverse effects. It involves MOUs typically between the involved federal agencies and the State Historic Preservation Officer in Sacramento, which can be time-consuming. If you look on the web under Section 106 process, agency after agency has different kinds of flowcharts, and they all have four big boxes, and it all looks very neat. But at least one agency was a bit more clear. This is what it really looks like. Now, this would and may come into play in our project through an angle that really wouldn't be obvious when you start off, which is simply this. Our project would change the release program for the dam. As a result, the amount of water in the lake would go up and down more often and be, what's the word, to a greater degree. Would be higher and lower than it is now. As it turns out, there are important cultural sites that are submerged by the reservoir and then uncovered as the lake goes down and back again and sands tend to wash away and those sorts of things. Our project may exacerbate that effect. That may be considered an effect on historic properties, and that could trigger the Section 106 process. Mm-hmm. Combined flow chart. And I was totally remiss in pointing out that in your handouts, you notice these slides are about 2 inches big, but the last 4 or 5 pages, I took the liberty of supplying full-size color charts because I had to wear my glasses and a magnifying glass to read the little ones. So if you want to tuck those away in a binder, and as we move through this process, we'll hopefully check them off. And then I always like to finish with this slide and a quote out of the staff report. I've given you a very brief overview and showed flowcharts and processes. But as we work through these things, the real work of the HCP is what's inside each of those boxes, not necessarily the fact that there are a lot of boxes or that they're connected in some logical or apparently logical way. And so I put the alligator there because things pop out that we could not possibly anticipate ahead of time. And this is the famous Black Lake long-tailed frog on the screen. I think I gave you a very brief update on where we were on the HCP. At this point, H.C. Harvey, our biologists, are essentially completing the four or five tasks that they could do efficiently in advance of having the final numbers on the downstream release program. In order to generate those final numbers, we're still waiting on a final result of the water availability analysis from Stetson, and I'm told that that document is imminent and landing on our desks. I apologize, I don't have a slide. You will recall that the 18-month schedule we had showed H.D. Harvey doing some upfront tasks and some tasks at the end once we had the availability analysis, and I had a blank in the middle, in a gap. We're in that gap, but we're towards the end of it. So I'm almost daily inquiring from Stetson engineers or our contract manager exactly where they are with those numbers. I'm happy to report that H.D. Harvey took the initiative based on information in the HCP to delve into their bag of experience and develop a methodology for relating stream flow to habitat conditions. And what I mean by that is there is a common methodology that's been used by years by fish people to say, well, when the flow is 3 CFS, the habitat conditions are this. When it's 6 CFS, it's this. That's a multi-month, complicated, many, many survey process. But H.D. Harvey and others in the business have developed a much, much more abbreviated process for getting to the same point. And that, more importantly, is much quicker and much cheaper to do than what's been done in the past. That's important to us because we anticipate that when the water availability analysis numbers are out and then working through the TAC and the subcommittee, we will be then going back to Stetson and asking him to show the results of various modified release curves. You'll recall that the downstream release program currently proposes a release of 3 CFS all summer long, with attraction flows in the winter. We've met with the farmers. We looked at the creek. We know that today we're releasing something like 7.5 to 8 CFS in order to maintain irrigation capability of the downstream agricultural. So 3 CFS, we don't think is going to get it. But by using the H.D. Harvey methodology and the capabilities of the model that's already been paid for, we think we can start going in and making subtle changes in an incremental basis and develop downstream release program to better satisfy our summertime users and also meet the agency's requirements of some sort of a natural-looking flow in the wintertime. H.D. Harvey's ability to quickly respond to those changes and produce documentation of what it means to the habitat is going to be critical in that process. So I'm anticipating getting heavily into that in the next couple of months as we get the information from Stetson engineers. And with that, I'll answer any questions that you have.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question. You mentioned it. I didn't catch it. Who's the NEPA lead agency? Who's the NEPA lead agency? Is it the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or NIMS?
NIMS, National Marine Fisheries
Okay.
Service.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? No? We're all still awake. Well, thank you so much. That was a very good report. I didn't know about all those different agencies that we were going to have to take care of and respond to. And so everything is in progress concurrently with all of those agencies.
We're ready to go.
We're ready to go.
One more question.
Okay.
So just for as timing, when do you see, what is your kind of a timing for NOP, draft EIR, that kind of thing?
I think where we're going to be at, and one of the things we're going to have to, you know, make a judgment call on is if we are, say, 9 to 10 months, I think that's on the schedule, with having a document that we can submit to National Marine Fisheries and say, process this. We'll then have to make a decision based on their initial process.
Thank you. Maybe I'm jumping the gun, but as far as, I mean, the HCP is the project description for the EIR and the NEPA document, correct?
Yes.
And I know, where are we with the HCP as being forming a project description for those environmental documents?
I think where we are is what we have as a project, as you know, is really a release program.
Mm-hmm.
That's the heart of the HCP. It's fairly well put together as far as its impacts and whatever. The question is, what kind of changes do we need to make to that release program to satisfy some concerns that we've identified with agricultural and downstream impacts? So we don't want to get too heavily into the EIR process or even into the impact side of the HCP before we have that adjustments made and some agreement from National Marine Fisheries, or at least understand the disagreements before we move ahead.
Now, and that release schedule, is it firmed up by the advisory board or some subcommittee or the county in some type of tacit agreement says, okay, this is the project description to move forward with based on feedback that you've received from the agencies, let's proceed with preparation of the environmental documents? Is there some type of decision-making step for that or not?
I think there will be.
Okay.
Typically, and as you know, and I'm not sure that other agencies work this, in the Public Works Department, it's really the staff that formulates the project description. The board takes a high level, and mm-hmm. you know, they'll say, bridge replacement, this is the budget. But in this case, because we have a TAC, and we have a TAC subcommittee, and we have an advisory committee that's also out to the public, I anticipate working with the TAC subcommittee to come up with a release schedule, presenting that to the full TAC, getting feedback on that, if we have agreement there, and also agreement on the potential impacts and mitigation that it might have, then bring that to the full advisory committee for your input, because you have such a wide perspective on these things. I wouldn't anticipate it necessarily going to the Board of Supervisors up front unless there's some key critical decision that needs to be made. If we come down to there's only two alternatives and one has these kinds of impacts and the other one has these kinds of impacts, I could anticipate that we would, based on your committee's recommendation, then go to the full board of the Flood Control District and say, how do we proceed, you know? Especially if there's, significant negative impacts, no matter how we go forward, we would have to get, the governing board's decision, obviously, with your input on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
Just one comment, Mark. I wonder if, because of the size of your slides and the handout, if you could email the PowerPoint to us so we could put it up on full screen.
Certainly.
My eyes aren't that good.
Do you want, and I have to ask, I can PDF that so you have PDF pages, or I can leave it in PowerPoint so that you can cut pieces out and
that'd be nice.
And use it.
PowerPoint would be fine, thanks.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay.
Good idea.
Just one more question, sir. since the rainy season will start in 4 months, right?
Yes.
Is there anything that is going to be able to help facilitate, how we control the water this year?
There's several things going on.
Besides the pump that they planned on?
Well, the pump is, the concept is still there, but...
Please make it go away.
We'll have the... Well, Coastal Commission kind of did that. We'll have the... certainly the road crews out in force. We've already had a crew in the Rio Grande Channel throughout the flood control, making sure that each and every flap gate on the inside of the channel is open and clear and has a flow to the creek so that nothing's going to get backed up by a pipe and the water's going to go the wrong way through a pipe.
Can I ask just one humble question? Is that you actually take a couple local people with you, because there has been incidents where Public Works didn't know where the flood...
I'm aware of that. That's why there's now actually markers on the levee where they all are, and there's also...
The ones that have been identified, but there are a couple more that have not been identified
I'll know about. I'll give that feedback to you, too.
So, if you could do that, I think that's good quality assurance.
There's a couple of more things that are bigger. You can anticipate within the next month that a crew will be in the lagoon. We managed to get a permit from Coastal Commission, actually a waiver, and one from the Department of Fish and Game to go into the bull rush and cut them down to water level in a path 10 feet wide to connect the open water to the flap gates and then also back up into Aloha. Very definitely a temporary measure.
but at least we'll be able to see through the bulrush as to where the water's supposed to flow. We also have some foundational information, I'll call it, from a consultant who's looking at the sandbar. So that in an event we decided we needed to go onto the beach and lower the sandbar, we have the basic information to present to the Coastal Commission to get an emergency permit, and also state parks to get an encroachment permit to go on their property and open up the sandbar where it flows out. Although I should say at this point, our survey
bridge work that's currently underway, and we know we've discussed that for a long time, and then a couple other projects. I'll discuss a couple other projects that are wrapping up, but just right before our July meeting that was ultimately canceled, we opened up construction bids for Rodriguez Bridge, and we were very fortunate to have them come in significantly under bid. The low bidder was $249,000. They just started work within the last few days as far as physical work, and this presentation I'd like to give you is Arthur's Construction, and they need to have their work done. They need to be out of the creek by October 31st, so they're really working hard on getting these rock weirs in place to help protect the waterline pipe that's in the concrete encasement. So I'll walk you through these here the best I can. This is the staging area just to the west of downstream from Rodriguez Bridge, and what the contractor is doing is sorting the boulder material that's been delivered into different sizes. So as he drops it into the weirs, he has the size that he needs already at hand. Another photo here. Some of these boulders are quite large, over 4 feet in length, that are being scooped up and dropped in all downstream of the concrete encasement. So upstream, there's both an upstream and a downstream diversion dam. So the creek's dry where they're actually doing the work, and this is the upper diversion dam. And this is the lower diversion dam, and it's pretty good, just almost 100 yards. I don't know the exact length, but it's a pretty good run. You can see it here. So the creek is in that black pipe on the left side of the screen and runs from the upper dam down to the lower dam. And this is the one weir just upstream of the bridge, and it's the one that he was working on yesterday, and we'll be working on it for a few days. It's going to have a 6-inch. It's going to be 6 inches higher than the concrete encased pipe that's upstream from this weir. And I apologize. When I was out there, the lighting was bad. It's the best I could do. But he's laying in the larger boulders first and working his way up. And this is from the top of the bridge, looking down as he's placing them. So that's Rodriguez Bridge, and we're hoping by mid-October that work will be wrapped up there, and they'll be out of the creek in sufficient time. They do have two other projects that are underway. One is the chemical containment improvements, and this was from the result of a spill we had, a previous spill, and it's basically a detention tank that's plumbed to some of the storm drains on site at the water treatment plant, and the trucks will park there and do their unloading of chemicals, and if there is a spill, it's on a asphalt driveway. It will drain to the drains and down into the tank that will catch any sort of chemical spill. And that one's just about done. And then a road is being built up to the water tank above the water treatment plant, and that one's substantially complete. And when it is done, I'll bring pictures back at our November meeting, just like I. And I'll bring some more for Rodriguez Bridge as well. So those are the two projects. That one's estimated to be under budget as well, so good news on both of those. Additional good news is that we were contacted in June from the State Department of Public Health that they had some Prop 50 funds that they were going to do a second tier of awarding to agencies for this. This was under their security grant program, and it's for preventing damage, disruption, and intentional contamination of water systems. And we had some projects, two in the queue. that qualified and one that wasn't in the queue, but we wanted to apply for because of this grant opportunity. So we didn't have a meeting. We didn't have that July meeting to bring this forward to you to discuss, but staff's been working with the TAC on developing eligible projects, and you can see in the staff report there's three. The first is the terminal reservoir fencing that was budgeted and planned to be constructed, and it's an eligible cost, so it's a 50-50 grant that we're anticipating we'll get through this program. The Lopez turnouts, having a SCADA system put on all of them, was also in the queue, and that is eligible for the grant, so we're bringing that forward under the grant application. And then on Orchid Road, where Orchid Road bisects the terminal reservoir, there's some drainage culverts that capture surface runoff there from the road and drain into the terminal reservoir, and that can be, that's obviously eligible, and so those it's proposed to have those diverted away from the terminal reservoir.
So could any combination of these projects be funded? I mean, could it be one or all three, or I mean, is it sort of all or nothing?
I believe that it's not all or nothing. That they could say, yeah, we're going to do the fencing and not the other two, or all three, or you get 30% of all three. I don't know the exact details, but that's normally how the grant programs work.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. All right, then let's move forward on to item 9A.
Okay, this is the bylaw update, and we briefly covered this earlier, but the bylaws that your board, the amendments that your board approved in May were taken to the Board of Supervisors in July and approved, and they are in effect for this fiscal year, and there were no amendments made. So the significant change, at least operationally, is the chair and vice chair on a rotating basis, and that's started.
All right, thank you. Okay, well, we're going to move forward to item 10. There are no action items at this time. On 11, do we have any future agenda items we'd like to discuss? Nope. All right. And committee member comments. Anyone would like to make a comment? No?
I just want to, I wonder if, John, next time... the staff could come back with more information on the calculation of surplus and where we stand on the usage of surplus and how that might be projected into future years, because it might be, we might be looking at a declining surplus entitlement as we go through future years. And it might be good to have the advisory committee and perhaps the viewing public to better understand how we're using surplus water out of Lopez, as well as our regular entitlements. Maybe that's a future agenda type of an item. Sorry.
Okay. Duly noted.
Okay. Anyone else? No? All right. Well, our next regular meeting is tentatively scheduled for Thursday, November 15th at Aurora Grande. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.